The previous fall, there had been a rare success. Pakistani forces had staged an offensive in the rural Swat Valley, seizing control and capturing Taliban militants. But it wasn't long before rumors began to circulate about what exactly that success had entailed. Public reports were emerging of a new wave of executions in the wake of military operations in Swat. By that summer, Human Rights Watch had investigated 238 alleged executions and found at least 50 were heavily corroborated. As with everything in government, the executions even had an acronym, EJK, for extrajudicial killings. The issue was complex. In rural Pakistan, courtrooms and prisons were more the stuff of aspiration than reality. Some Pakistani military units viewed summary executions as the only practical way of dealing with extremists they apprehended. But the tactic was also proving useful in disposing of a growing number of dissidents, lawyers, and journalists. Pakistani military personnel, when they could be enticed to acknowledge the issue at all, bitterly pointed out that the United States pressed them to target some bad guys, then complained when they took out others. The killings were a point of extraordinary sensitivity in the relationship between Pakistan and the United States. For the Pakistanis, they were an embarrassment. For the Americans, they were a fly in the ointment. American taxpayers had bankrolled Pakistan to the tune of $19.7 billion in military and civilian assistance since September 11, 2001. Revelations about the murders raised the specter of unwanted scrutiny. Inside the State Department, I circulated news of the video and of mounting calls for a response from human rights watchdogs. The results were Kafkaesque. Officials set to work quashing meetings with the groups behind the reporting. When they acquiesced to a single briefing in Washington with Human Rights Watch, it was with the understanding that we would allow no questions of the U.S. government and that our comments be limited to very general press guidance. A career bureaucrat with a prim demeanor and a vacant smile responded to my emails on the subject with a cheerful suggestion. Sent Monday, March 8, 2010, 4:43 p.m. Subject, Re-Extrajudicial Executions, Human Rights Watch Meeting Request. One suggestion, rather than specifically referencing the term EJK, we've been trying to work these issues under the umbrella of gross violations of human rights, statutory language lifted from Leahy provisions. One advantage of using the Leahy phrasing is that it covers the broad swath of abuses, including EJK, of concern to the USG. Another is that it encompasses abuses committed by insurgents as well as those attributed to government forces and agencies. The bonus is that it helps to insulate open-source meetings from the sensitive policy discussions on the high side. Just a semantic twist in service of diplomacy. The statute she was referring to, named after its sponsor, Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, banned giving American assistance to foreign military units committing atrocities. I forwarded the exchange to a colleague. "Oh boy, how Rwanda press conferences circa 1994 is this," I wrote, referring to the semantic twists U.S. officials undertook to avoid using the word genocide in the midst of that crisis. Several months later, I pushed a dossier across a conference table toward Milan Verveer, Hillary Clinton's ambassador-at-large for global women's issues. We were both visiting Islamabad, and she'd asked what human rights groups were saying. I printed up some of the reporting, nothing classified, just open-source documents. All the same, I stuck to euphemisms. There's a spike in gross violations of human rights. "And when you say gross violations," she said, flipping through the file, "executions." It was June, Islamabad's hottest month of the year, and the air felt close in the cramped room at the American Embassy in Pakistan. Across the table from the two of us, a diplomat stationed at the embassy glared at me. She'd shot me a warning look when the topic came up. Now her lips were pursed, her eyes boring into me. On the table in front of her, her knuckles were marble white. Ambassador Robin Rafel, the career Foreign Service officer who was overseeing a spike in American assistance to Pakistan that year, was furious. Later that week, embassy staff and locals gathered outside the American ambassador's residence in Islamabad's secure Red Zone. Nestled at the foot of the densely forested Margalla Hills, the city's wide avenues are lined with eucalyptus and pine trees. By that June in 2010, its parks and lawns were an explosion of white gladiolus and purple amaranthus. At night, the posh districts hummed with intellectual energy. As the war raged nearby, an international set of diplomats, reporters, and aid workers met for golden-haloed cocktail parties, exchanging whispers of palace intrigue. Robin Rafel had been a fixture at such parties for years, since she began working in Pakistan decades earlier. To many locals, she was simply Robin. That night at the ambassador's residence, she was in her element, holding forth for a clutch of partygoers. With high cheekbones and ramrod straight posture, she had an aristocratic quality, her blonde hair pulled into a tight French twist. She spoke with a locked jaw and the clipped mid-Atlantic cadence of a 1940s movie star. Tossed over one shoulder, she wore, as she so often did, an embroidered pashmina shawl that made her dress suit resemble the flowing salwar kameez of the local women. Since that day in the conference room, Rafel had done her utmost to kneecap the junior diplomat who had responded to the question about human rights. When she couldn't keep me out of meetings, she would cut me off in them with relish. That night at the party, she made little secret of her disapproval. "How dare you bring up," here she lowered her voice conspiratorially, "EJK in a meeting at this embassy." Her lip quivered. "You are not of value on that issue." I wondered how much she was frustrated by my criticism of America's role in Pakistan, and how much she just found me personally annoying. I explained, trying to stay deferential, that the State Department had adopted a policy of acknowledging the human rights reporting, even if we didn't confirm it. "Well, that may be the case in D.C., she sniffed. She fingered the loop of pearls at her neck. "This isn't D.C., and we do not discuss that issue here." It would be 3 years before the gutting of Mahogany Row, but in national security hotspots like this, you could see the power slipping away from diplomats in real time. Pakistan was the perfect illustration of the trend. For decades, the Pentagon and the CIA had bypassed the United States' civilian foreign policy systems to do business directly with Pakistan's military and intelligence leaders. In the years since September 11, 2001, they'd gained more freedom than ever to do so. Standing in the warm Islamabad summer, I wondered at Robin Rafel, so keen to avoid tough questions about a foreign military and its entanglements with our own. What did she understand her role to be at a time in which so much of that role was being carved away and carted off? When 19th-century pundits suggested quarantining diplomats lest they bring back mixed allegiances, was this what they meant? Was this something old or something new? For decades, Robin Rafel embodied a tradition of old-school diplomacy. Born Robin Lynn Johnson, she grew up in a sleepy lumber town in Washington State, tearing through the National Geographic magazines her father collected and dreaming of the wider world. At Mark Morris High, she was voted most likely to succeed. "She seemed to have a worldly sense about her," remembered one classmate. In college, she'd leapt at opportunities to travel, spending a summer in Tehran with a church group before heading to a junior year abroad at the University of London. "Are you still religious?" I once asked her. She snorted derisively. This seemed an absurd question to her. "What do you mean, am I still religious?" she snapped. When pressed, she waved a hand dismissively. "I wouldn't say one way or another." If Robin Rafel had time for spirituality, she didn't have time to share it with me. She was all flinty pragmatism. She prided herself on it. After college, she spent a year studying at Cambridge and found a dazzling set of fellow Americans with their own international dreams and yearbook superlatives. It was the height of the Vietnam War, and the dorms of Oxford and Cambridge filled with debate about an American proxy war gone wrong. There were eerie parallels to another war that would, decades later, have a cataclysmic impact on Robin Rafel's life. Another new administration, faced with a fatigued public, an uncooperative partner force, and an elusive insurgency with safe havens across a tactically challenging border. Rafel, then still Johnson, started dating a young Rhodes Scholar and fellow University of Washington graduate, Frank Aller, and befriended his roommates, Strobe Talbot, who would go on to become a journalist and deputy secretary of state, and an aspiring politician named Bill Clinton. In their modest house at 46 Leckford Road in North Oxford, the friends spent hours agonizing over the threat of the draft. Clinton and Aller were both classified as 1A, available to be drafted, and both opposed the war. Clinton considered various strategies for avoiding the draft, but ultimately decided against them, as he put it, "to maintain my political viability within the system." Aller, on the other hand, stayed in England, on the run from the draft, and agonized by the resulting stigma. A year later, he went home to Spokane, put a .22 caliber Smith & Wesson in his mouth, and blew his brains out. I asked Rafel how Aller's death, so soon after they dated, affected her. Oh, she said, as if I'd asked her about a fender bender. I was very upset, needless to say. She paused, realizing how she'd sounded. As you've no doubt noticed, I'm passionate about being dispassionate. Robin Rafel wasn't about to let emotion be an obstacle to the life on the world stage she was, even then, beginning to craft. In the following years, her path would wind from Tehran to Islamabad to Tunisia. Over the course of that journey, Rafel's critics would not share her dispassion. By the end of her career, she would be called a traitor, a turncoat, and a terrorist sympathizer. In the Indian press, she was called, with delight, Lady Taliban. The astonishing nadir would come during the Obama administration. 4 years after our run-in in Islamabad, Rafel arrived at her desk on the first floor of the State Department, in a sea of cubicles not far from the cafeteria. She checked her email and took a few routine meetings. It was early afternoon when she saw the missed calls. The first was from Sloman's home security. Someone had been trying to get into Rafel's house. The next call was from her daughter Alexandra, who was panicked. Rafel had to get home immediately, Alexandra said. Rafel got into her Ford Focus and drove the 20-minute route to her home in Northwest Washington, D.C. When she arrived, she saw a dozen FBI agents crawling over her modest two-story Cape Cod-style house. Two earnest-looking agents in plainclothes approached her and showed her their badges. Next, they handed her a warrant. It specified that Robin Rafel was being investigated under 18 U.S.C. Section 793E, a criminal statute that covers the illegal gathering or transmission of national security information. Espionage. Chapter 3. Dick. Vietnam was a spectral horror for the friends at 46 Leckford in the late 1960s. But for other young men, the war had an almost magnetic pull. Richard Holbrooke, who years later became close to Strobe Talbot and through him Bill Clinton, sought out the war as a proving ground. His experiences there would echo through 40 years of American warfare. Decades later, he would become one of the last voices to carry the lessons of Vietnam into the modern conflict in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Holbrooke was a New Yorker born to Jewish parents. He was Dick to his friends until his elegant third wife enforced a transition to the more genteel Richard. His enemies never transitioned. Dick Holbrooke was grasping, relentless, wore his ambition on his sleeve, the kind of person who could go in a revolving door behind you and come out ahead of you, one friend said. He was oblivious to social graces in the pursuit of his goals. While making an impassioned point, he once followed Hillary Clinton into a women's room. In Pakistan, she would stress in the retelling. A former flame recalled waiting with him endlessly for a cab during a torrential storm in Manhattan. When one finally approached, he kissed her on the cheek and hopped in without a word, leaving her in the downpour. As Pamela Harriman, the socialite-turned-diplomat, once remarked tartly, "He's not entirely housebroken." He always struck me as vast, not so much taller but somehow more expansive than his 6-foot-1-inch frame. He had pale eyes and a gaze like a bird of prey, but also an irrepressible twinkle, his thin lips always on the verge of a smirk. His eruptions of temper were legendary, but he would just as often go still, dropping his voice to a near whisper. He deployed both tactics in a singular negotiating style he compared to a combination of chess and mountain climbing, flattering, bullying, charming, and intimidating his way to persuasion. He wrote voluminously and had the uncanny ability to speak in crisp, complete paragraphs. As oblivious as he could be to the sensitivities of people around him, he was a detailed observer of the world and indomitable in his excitement about it. In other words, he was the rare asshole who was worth it. As a child, he idolized scientists, Einstein, Fermi, but his interest turned to the wider world. After his father succumbed to colon cancer, he grew close to the family of his classmate, David Rusk, whose father, Dean, would soon become Kennedy's Secretary of State, and who visited Holbrooke's class at Scarsdale High School to extol the virtues of the Foreign Service. At the time, it was journalism that captivated Holbrooke. He was sports editor at his high school's newspaper, then editor-in-chief of his college's, the Brown Daily Herald, where his analyses of Cold War tensions ran under announcements for cheerleading tryouts. As a sophomore, he convinced his editors to send him to the 1960 Four Powers Summit in Paris, where Western leaders were set to meet with Nikita Khrushchev to try to ease tensions over the division of Berlin. The summit was a spectacular failure. Days before, the Soviets shot down a U-2 spy plane, and the ensuing confrontation soon shut down the talks. James Scotty Reston of the New York Times, whom Holbrooke idolized and who gave the young student journalist a job fetching drinks for the Times team in Paris, told Holbrooke, "Whether you go into journalism or the Foreign Service as a career, you'll always be able to say, I started my career at the worst diplomatic fiasco ever held." He was wrong. Holbrooke would see worse. After graduating from Brown, he tried and failed to get a job at the Times and decided to take the Foreign Service exam. So it was that newly minted Foreign Service officer Richard Holbrooke arrived at Tan Son Nhut Airport in Saigon on a muggy June night in 1963. Vietnam was the first modern test of American counterinsurgency, the strategy of securing a vulnerable population while winning its loyalty through social programs. During a Foreign Service training course, Holbrooke and his Vietnam-bound contemporaries, including Anthony Lake, who would later become Clinton's national security advisor, whiled away sweltering nights playing a game called fan ball, which involved throwing a tennis ball at a ceiling fan, then scrambling to chase it as it ricocheted around the room. They could hardly have designed a more conspicuous Vietnam metaphor if they tried. At the time of his arrival, 22-year-old Holbrooke was single and could be sent to the rural front lines to oversee development programs. It gave him an unvarnished view of mounting failures that his superiors in Washington lacked. He also witnessed the precipitous militarization of policymaking in Vietnam. During a trip with the 9th Marine Regiment in rural Da Nang, Holbrooke watched General Louis Walt, commander of the Marine Amphibious Force, kneel and push away semicircles of sand in front of him, showing how the Americans would supposedly push out the Viet Cong, making way for the South Vietnamese and good governance. A group of Vietnamese children looked on, chattering curiously. Holbrooke, never one to mince words, pointed out, "But the VC will just move in behind you." The general and Americans across Vietnam kept on pushing for years. Despite the hours and days of instruction they had in counterinsurgency, despite all the briefings which emphasized the political nature of the war, they could not understand what was going on or how to deal with it, Holbrooke wrote in one unpublished memo. The insurgents would not give up, and the locals were not going to switch sides in return for some free soap. Holbrooke dissented loudly. During his time in the provinces, he once argued openly with General William Westmoreland, the commander of U.S. forces in Vietnam. "How old are you?" Westmoreland finally asked, exasperated. 24. "What makes you think you know so much?" "I don't know," said Holbrooke, "but I've been here 2 years and I've spent all of the time in the field." Westmoreland was reporting back to Washington his conviction that he could break the insurgency through increasing levels of force. As Holbrooke ascended to positions at the White House and State Department, he sent vigorous, often unsolicited, memos to his bosses. "I have never seen the Americans in such disarray," he wrote in one when he was just 26. 40 years later, when I was working for him as the military pushed for a troop surge in Afghanistan, Holbrooke unearthed the memo and had me forward it to his Vietnam buddies. When the Department of Defense launched the top-secret review of Vietnam, eventually known as the Pentagon Papers, an official named Leslie Gelb, who went on to become the head of the Council on Foreign Relations and a lifelong friend to Holbrooke, tapped the iconoclastic young diplomat to write one volume. Holbrooke's contributions were scathing. The counterinsurgency was faultily conceived and clumsily executed. The Hawks, he argued, had dangerously commandeered policymaking. When the legendary diplomat Averill Harriman headed a delegation to negotiate with the North Vietnamese, Holbrooke numbed his bosses into submission, hustling for a spot on the team. He believed in the power of negotiation to end the war. "Holbrooke wants to always talk with the other side," said Nicholas Katzenbach, the Undersecretary of State who was Holbrooke's boss in the late 1960s. "He always thinks there's some negotiation, some middle road." But Paris was an agonizing failure. During a close presidential race, the Nixon campaign, it later emerged, worked to scuttle the talks, encouraging South Vietnam to drag its feet. Famously, the team wasted 2 months arguing over the shape of the negotiating table as the war raged. Shortly after Nixon took office, Holbrooke resigned and left government. It was neither foreordained nor inevitable that the war should continue with another 25,000 Americans and countless Vietnamese dead, he later wrote. A negotiated end to the war in 1968 was possible. The distance to peace was far smaller than most historians realize. He'd seen the United States squander one chance to end a war. He wouldn't let it happen again. As the war in Afghanistan raged in September 2010, the State Department Historian's Office released the final volume in the government's official history of Vietnam. Richard Holbrook walked from his office to the State Department's George C. Marshall Conference Center to deliver remarks on the publication, which contained one of his early memos. It was a gray day, and he wore a gray, rumpled suit and stood in front of a gray drop cloth. The fluorescent lights cast deep shadows under his eyes. He paused a little more often than usual. When an audience member asked about the parallels between Afghanistan and Vietnam, Holbrook managed a wan smile. I was wondering how long we could avoid that question. He spoke carefully. As Holbrook's contemporaries slipped from power and a new generation took hold, the word Vietnam increasingly registered as an unwelcome history lesson. But privately, I had heard him lay out the comparison. In Vietnam, the United States had been defeated by a country adjacent to the conflict, harboring enemy safe havens across a porous border. By our reliance on a corrupt partner government, and by an embrace of a failing counterinsurgency doctrine at the behest of the military establishment. In Afghanistan, he was witnessing echoes of all three dynamics, including yet another administration favoring military voices and missing opportunities for negotiation. Dick Holbrook was, of course, a friend of mine, Henry Kissinger said. It was a fair comparison, he observed at the parallels Holbrook drew between Vietnam and Afghanistan. In both cases, the United States would find itself applying frameworks that had worked elsewhere in the world with disastrous results. Vietnam was the attempt to apply the containment principles of Europe to Asia, Kissinger continued. But in Europe, containment was applied to societies that had existed for hundreds of years and whose internal structure was relatively stable except for the impact of the war. Vietnam had proved to be another matter entirely. Likewise, in Afghanistan, the question after 9/11 was, can we turn Afghanistan into a democratic government which no longer supports such efforts, as Kissinger put it? That was the wrong question. That day at the State Department, Richard Holbrook was quick to point out that Afghanistan was not Vietnam. The inciting event, an attack on American soil, made the strategic calculus different. But structurally, there are obvious similarities, he said. And leafing through these books here, they leap out at you. Many of the programs that are being followed, many of the basic doctrines, are the same ones that we were trying to apply in Vietnam. Chapter 4. The Mango Case. Shortly after Richard Holbrook left behind the wreckage of Vietnam and resigned from the Nixon administration, Robin Rafel departed Cambridge and returned to Iran, taking a job teaching history at Damavand College for Women. Before the fall of the Shah, Tehran was cosmopolitan and welcoming. Rafel danced and acted in U.S.-backed theater productions, including one of Anything Goes. She fell in love with a handsome, funny Foreign Service officer, Arnold Rafel, Arnie to friends. In 1972, they married on the grounds of the American Embassy in an interfaith ceremony bringing together his Judaism, her Christianity, and a lot of 1970s velvet. When he was posted to Pakistan in 1975, Rafel went with him. Pakistan didn't faze her any more than Iran had. Islamabad was a sleepy town, lush and green, with a third of its current population. It was great, Rafel recalled, lighting up at the memory. It was up and coming. She joined the Foreign Service and took a job at USAID. The young American couple cut a glamorous profile, throwing cocktail parties and hosting screenings of American movies. She slipped effortlessly into Pakistani high society, developing a network of connections that would serve and haunt her in years to come. For Rafel, like generations of Foreign Service officers before her, advancing American influence was about friendship and conversation. You need to be engaged and figure out what makes people tick and what motivates them, she said. To me, that's blindingly obvious. She reflected on this for a moment. But sometimes we forget, and in this post-9/11 more urgent and demanding time, we fell into finger-wagging demanding. Just a few years after Rafel's first golden days in Islamabad, a transformation swept the region. When the secular, American-backed Shah of Iran fell to an Islamist revolution in 1979, it cemented America's reliance on Pakistan as a military and intelligence partner. The United States had lost important listening stations in Iran used to monitor the Soviets. The CIA approached Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, the ISI, which agreed to build Pakistani facilities to fill the void. The call of Islamic revolution also sounded from Iran to neighboring Afghanistan, where a Soviet-backed Marxist regime had seized control a year earlier. Under the guidance of the KGB, the Marxists had instituted secular reforms, including mandatory girls' education. On propaganda posters, women with red babushkas and red lips held open books under Cyrillic, screaming, "If you don't read books, you'll forget the letters." For conservative Afghans, it was too much. The Afghan army erupted against the communists. Initially, the Soviets hesitated as the revolt spread. But in Moscow, diplomacy had been sidelined, and the KGB's influence had swelled. KGB chief Yuri Andropov neatly bypassed Soviet diplomats voicing caution. On Christmas Eve, transport planes loaded with Soviet troops landed at Kabul airport. The Carter administration saw the invasion as a chance to embarrass Moscow. Carter greenlit a covert war orchestrated through the United States military alliance with Pakistan. "It is essential that Afghanistan's resistance continues," National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote. "This means more money as well as arms shipments to the rebels. To make this possible, we must both reassure Pakistan and encourage it to help the rebels. This will require a review of our policy toward Pakistan, more guarantees to it, more arms aid, and alas, a decision that our security policy toward Pakistan cannot be dictated by our non-proliferation policy." Pakistan had not been a paragon of virtue in the late 1970s. Its military dictator, Mohammad Zia-ul-Haq, hanged the civilian leader he had forced out of office, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, and canceled elections. Pakistan was aggressively pursuing the atom bomb, resisting American calls to stand down. In the name of the war with the Soviets, as was the case in the later War on Terror, all those concerns were secondary. Over the course of Reagan's first term, Congress's approved funding for the covert war swelled from tens to hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Zia insisted that guns purchased with those funds be dispersed entirely on Pakistan's terms. A top-secret presidential finding at the outset of the war called for the CIA to defer to Pakistan. One Islamabad station chief remembered his orders this way: "Take care of the Pakistanis and make them do whatever you need them to do." When Zia visited Reagan, Secretary of State Shultz wrote a memo advising that, "We must remember, without Zia's support, the Afghan resistance, key to making the Soviets pay a heavy price for their Afghan adventure, is effectively dead." When I asked Shultz about his advocacy for the Pakistani regime, he was unapologetic. "Zia and President Reagan, they had a relationship. The whole idea was helping the Mujahideen get the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan," he said, using the Arabic word for Muslim fighters engaged in jihad, like those fighting the Soviets. "And we succeeded." And so, as Zia insisted, weapons would be given to Pakistan's ISI, which would hand-select the Mujahideen who received the spoils. The United States, still stinging from the complexities of managing a proxy war in Vietnam, was happy to leave the details to Pakistan. Amid the urgency of battle with the Soviets, the partnership's less pleasant realities were easy to overlook. Pakistani officers sold their CIA-supplied weapons on the black market. Once, they even sold them back to the CIA. Pakistan continued to brazenly flaunt its nuclear development. In 1985, the Senate passed the so-called Pressler Amendment, requiring the president to certify, on an annual basis, that Pakistan didn't possess nukes. The rule was strict: no certification, no assistance. Zia lied to President Reagan about the Pakistani nuclear program. "There is no question that we had an intelligence basis for not certifying from 1987 on," said one veteran CIA official. But Reagan continued to certify that Pakistan was non-nuclear anyway. Ohio Senator John Glenn argued that nuclear proliferation was a far greater danger to the world than being afraid to cut off the flow of aid to Afghanistan. It's the short term versus the long term. But he was a rare voice of dissent. The covert war also required that the Americans turn a blind eye to the brutality of the jihad being armed across the border. The Pakistanis passed the American arms to the most ruthless of the Islamist hardliners, radicals like Abdul Sayyaf and Burhanuddin Rabbani and Jalaluddin Haqqani, all with strong ties to terrorist networks. One of the ISI's favored sons was Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, a vicious fundamentalist who reputedly specialized in skinning captured soldiers alive and whose men indiscriminately murdered civilians. A pugnacious CIA agent named Milt Bearden took over the program in the latter half of the 1980s. By his estimate, the Pakistanis gave nearly a quarter of the American spoils to Hekmatyar. "Hekmatyar was a favorite of the Pakistanis, but he certainly wasn't a favorite of mine," he told me. He added flatly, "I really should have shot him when I had the chance." International Islamists were attracted like moths to the fires of extremism stoked by the Pakistanis and Americans. A wealthy Saudi patron named Osama bin Laden moved to Pakistan in the mid-1980s and drew close to some of the ISI's favored jihadis, including Hekmatyar and Sayaf. He offered cash stipends to fighters from the ISI's training camps and eventually established his own, modeled closely after the ISI's. And it worked. Within a few years, the CIA declared the covert war cost-effective. The true costs became apparent later. Robin and Arnold Raifel had moved to Washington, D.C. just before the war with the Soviets broke out, and a lot of stuff went south, as she would later put it. This was an accurate description of events in both the U.S.-Pakistani relationship and her own. She wanted children, Arnold didn't. They divorced in the early 1980s. Raifel would have two subsequent marriages and two daughters, but friends described Arnold as the love of Robin Raifel's life. One sensed she'd sooner jump out of a window than cop to such sentimentality. Arnold, still a rising star in the Foreign Service, returned to Pakistan as U.S. ambassador. On a hot afternoon in August 1988, he joined President Zia in a stretch of desert near the provincial city of Bahawalpur for a demonstration of the American Abrams tank, the latest offering to be purchased with Pakistan's still ongoing flood of assistance, and then accepted a last-minute invitation to join Zia in his American-made C-130 Hercules for the commute back to Islamabad. They were joined by Zia's chief of staff and ISI chief General Akhtar, who had hand-selected the Mujahideen supported by America's covert war, along with General Herbert M. Wassam, who oversaw U.S. military assistance to Pakistan. Exactly 5 minutes after they took off, the plane plunged into the desert and exploded into a massive fireball. All 30 souls aboard were dead, including Zia-ul-Haq and Arnold Raifel. The incident is, to this day, one of the great unsolved mysteries of Pakistani history. Although an American ambassador had been killed and the FBI had statutory authority to investigate, Secretary of State Shultz ordered FBI investigators to stay away. Milt Bearden likewise kept the CIA away. The only Americans allowed on the site, 7 Air Force investigators, ruled out mechanical failure in a secret report. The only possibility was sabotage. A canister containing VX nerve gas or a similar agent could have wiped out the plane, perhaps. A long-standing conspiracy theory held that nerve gas was secreted in a case of mangoes loaded on board before takeoff. For Pakistan, the crash deepened mistrust of the Americans. General Begg, who seized power afterwards, was as committed as Zia to Pakistan's nuclear development and support for terrorist proxies, but less friendly to the United States. For Robin Raifel, the tragedy severed her from those early, hopeful days in Tehran. When I asked about losing Arnold, she gave a small, brittle laugh. "It would be difficult for anyone, but life goes on." That was the year the last of the Soviets pulled out of Afghanistan. The CIA station in Islamabad's cable relating the news read, simply, "We won." But the lack of broader strategic dialogue between the United States and Pakistan hit hard and fast once the Red Menace subsided. 4 months later, when Pakistan's new prime minister, Benazir Bhutto, made her first official trip to the United States, the cracks were already beginning to show. Bhutto, the daughter of Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, the prime minister over whose hanging Zia had presided, had returned to Pakistan after years of exile. Harvard-educated and just 35 years old, she cut a glamorous profile. Wearing a white headscarf, a golden-pink salwar kameez, and literally rose-colored aviator glasses, she stood in front of the American flag at a joint session of Congress and quoted Lincoln, Madison, and Kennedy. "Speaking for Pakistan, I can declare that we do not possess, nor do we intend to make, a nuclear device," she said emphatically. But days beforehand, Bhutto had sat at Blair House, kitty corner from the White House, and received an alarming briefing from CIA Director William H. Webster. According to one person who was present that day, Webster walked in with a soccer ball converted into a mock-up of the kind of nuclear prototype he now knew Pakistan possessed. Webster told Bhutto that if her country continued the process of converting its gaseous uranium into solid pits, the cores of atom bombs, there was no way President Bush could certify that Pakistan was non-nuclear later that year. Before the end of the month, the jig was up. The CIA had irrefutable evidence that Pakistan had machined its uranium into several cores. In 1990, just a year after the Soviets' departure from Afghanistan, George H.W. Bush became the first president to decline to certify that Pakistan remained non-nuclear. Under the terms of the Pressler Amendment, most economic and military assistance was suspended, and F-16 fighter jets ordered and paid for by Pakistan were left to collect dust in Arizona for years. To this day, the F-16s are a point of obsession for every Pakistani military official I've met. They symbolize a betrayal America quickly forgot, and Pakistan never did. When the military relationship came screeching to a halt, there was little by way of meaningful diplomatic context to soften the blow. Even Milt Bearden, maestro of Mujahideen chaos, lamented the lack of dialogue. The relationship was always shallow, he remembered. When the Soviets marched out of Afghanistan in February 1989, within the next year we had sanctioned them and cut off military contacts. It set the tenor for the relationship in the following decade, with Pakistan in the role of jilted lover. They love to love us, reflected Bearden, but they really deeply believe that every time the chips are down, we screw them. Absent the urgency of a proxy war, the American foreign policy establishment turned on Pakistan. The country's support for militant Islam, once a convenience, was now a liability. When the Soviets left, the ISI attempted to install Hekmatyar, its favorite extremist, into power. But after he lost a bloody fight for Kabul, the Pakistanis turned to a different solution, arming and funding another conservative movement they hoped would serve as a counterbalance to their regional rival, India. The Students of Islam, or Taliban. Stories of the Taliban's hardline social policies and brutal repression of women began to reach the Western world. Incoming Secretary of State Madeleine Albright was among the ranks of establishment figures who began to rally against the regime for its deepening repression. "I do not regret not dealing with the Taliban," she said years later. "I am willing, however, to admit that it was very complex in terms of who really was in charge." That outrage gathered steam as the threat of the terrorists Taliban leaders were harboring became apparent. The 1998 bombings of two U.S. embassies in Africa and the revelation that their orchestrator, Osama bin Laden, had close ties to the Taliban sealed the regime's status as an international pariah. Pakistan, as the Taliban's benefactor, shared in that reputation. Robin Rafel was a lone voice of dissent. When Bill Clinton took office as president in 1993, he had tapped Rafel, his old friend from England, to become Assistant Secretary of State for South Asian Affairs. As relations between Washington and Islamabad chilled over the course of the 1990s, Rafel was a stalwart advocate for the country where she had formed so many relationships earlier in her career. When a senator named Hank Brown introduced legislation to ease restrictions on assistance to Pakistan, she worked with Pakistani diplomats for months, lobbying for the bill. Its passage in 1995 cleared the way for arms exports to Pakistan, despite the country's growing nuclear arsenal. Rafel was also an ardent defender of Benazir Bhutto, who returned to power during Rafel's first year as assistant secretary, and who was covertly authorizing assistance to the Taliban, while lying about it to the Americans. Rafel told me she went into the relationship with eyes open. "I didn't believe Bhutto. I felt we needed to be talking to everyone." Nevertheless, she argued against sanctions and helped secure assistance for Pakistan. Rafel also campaigned for talks with Taliban leaders. A cable summarizing one of her visits to Kabul in 1996 conveyed a rosy view of the regime. Quoting one leader who told Rafel, "We are not bad people," and optimistically describing the Taliban's growing awareness, previously absent, of their own limitations. Shortly after the Taliban took control of Kabul that year, Rafel called on other countries to embrace the regime at a closed-door session at the United Nations. They are Afghan. They are indigenous. They have demonstrated staying power, she said. It is not in the interests of Afghanistan or any of us here that the Taliban be isolated. As one veteran Pakistani diplomat who worked with Rafal for many years put it, if Robin had lasted another year as assistant secretary, there would be a Taliban embassy in Washington, D.C. Rafal, with her fringe embrace of the Pakistanis and the Taliban, aroused suspicion, both in Washington and in the region. This was the point at which the Indian press began tarring her as Lady Taliban, a moniker that would stick for decades. It was silly, she said, because I did go and talk to these people. That was my job. But because I wasn't horrified and didn't want to treat them like pariahs, people found it absolutely shocking that I thought it was perfectly normal to talk to them. She sighed. It was a mistake to demonize the Taliban. That might well have contributed to how they got totally out of hand. Nobody would listen to them. We blew them off and thought they were complete Neanderthal ragheads. It was, in her view, the worst kind of mistake. Emotionally driven. Many in the foreign policy establishment later embraced those same arguments for talking to the Taliban, including Richard Holbrooke. Did Rafal have any regrets about her more isolating and controversial positions, I asked. No, she told me with a laugh. I was ahead of my time. At the height of Rafal's efforts to warm relations with Pakistan in 1995, an aide from then-Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot's team knocked on her office door and told her about a troubling development. While surveilling Pakistani officials, intelligence agents had picked up what they took to be an illicit exchange. Rafal, they claimed, was leaking classified information to the Pakistanis, revealing the sensitive details of American intelligence on their nuclear program. Rafal was shaken. She met with the State Department's internal police, the Diplomatic Security Service, whose agents grilled her. Their investigation came up empty. Rafal wasn't cited for any infraction, and the matter was quickly forgotten. Though, it would later come to pass, not for good. Rafal rotated through several other roles, serving as ambassador in Tunisia and vice president of the National Defense University and coordinating assistance in the early days of the Iraq War. But her story always arced back to Pakistan. When she left Iraq, tired, in 2005, she joined Cassidy & Associates, the glossy K Street lobbying firm whose client list included the Egyptian intelligence services and, on occasion, Pakistan. During Rafal's time there, the firm had two Pakistani contracts, prompting the press, especially the Indian press, to call her a Pakistan lobbyist. Lobbyist who tormented New Delhi in the 1990s, screamed the Times of India, brazenly pro-Pakistan partisan in Washington. Rafal laughed at this, saying she only worked on one contract for 3 weeks, before the deal was cancelled when Pakistani strongman Pervez Musharraf suspended the country's constitution in November 2007. At a cocktail party in 2009, Rafal ran into fellow career Foreign Service officer and then sitting U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, Ann Patterson. Patterson was a small, steely woman from Fort Smith, Arkansas, who spoke in a quiet southern drawl and didn't mince words. She was a diplomat in the classic tradition, with decades of service from Latin America to the Middle East. In Pakistan, she was confronting a new era in one of the world's most difficult relationships. An era in which Pakistan had once again become essential to the United States. But Americans with deep contacts within Pakistani society were hard to come by. In the modern era, tough posts like Pakistan had become in-and-out assignments for junior officers looking to check a box and get a year or two of hazard pay, a 30% premium in Islamabad at the time. Someone with Rafal's grasp of the Gordian knot of Pakistani politics could be indispensable. Patterson asked Rafal if she'd come back for one more assignment, helping to manage assistance in Islamabad. Rafal had turned 61 by then. She'd been married 3 times, most recently to a British diplomat, a union that lasted just a few years and ended in 2004. She'd raised her 2 college-age daughters, Anna and Alexandra, mostly by herself. Lobbying had given her a chance to spend more time with them and with her friends. But her mind, one sensed, was quick to turn back to public service. She told Ann Patterson that she'd think about it. Chapter 5. The Other Haqqani Network. The day after President Clinton announced Robin Rafal's nomination as Assistant Secretary of State in 1993, she'd boarded a flight to Sri Lanka, en route to the funeral of the country's recently assassinated president. Seated near her were Pakistan's Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif, and a 36-year-old Pakistani diplomat named Hussein Haqqani. In the years that followed, Haqqani would become a fixture of U.S.-Pakistani relations. His critics would come to know him by some of the same labels ascribed later to Robin Rafel: turncoat, traitor, spy. Haqqani was urbane and charming and a flatterer. "As you know well," he often said with a feline smile, "as a man of your experience, of course, understands." He grew up in a lower middle-class neighborhood in Pakistan's commercial hub, Karachi. His parents were Indian migrants, his mother a schoolteacher, his father a lawyer who arrived in Pakistan with few professional contacts and turned to representing the poor and needy. The Haqqanis lived in a barracks for families uprooted by Pakistan's partition from India. Young Hussein was 14 before he lived in a real house. Like Holbrook, he wasn't born among elites. He clawed his way up. He received both a traditional Islamic education and a secular modern one. A quintessentially Pakistani fault line ran through him, between church and state, old and new, east and west. When he enrolled at Karachi University, he became a student leader associated with the Jamaat-e-Islami party, joining a new generation of Muslims sparking change around the region. But he was torn. He spent hours at the American Center in Karachi's U.S. consulate, devouring the books in its library. He soaked in Western perspectives and grew disenchanted with his peers' rising anti-Americanism. When an angry mob inflamed by anti-American sentiment burned down the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad in 1979, student leaders in nearby Karachi approached Haqqani and asked him to lead the charge. As he tells the story, he gave a dramatic speech citing the Quran to dissuade them from further violence. One ulterior motive he didn't tell the angry students about: he wanted to protect his beloved library inside the consulate and the Western books on its shelves. Like Holbrook, Haqqani was drawn to journalism and diplomacy. He wrote for the Far Eastern Economic Review and later worked with Pakistani state-run television, sometimes burnishing the legacy of Zia-ul-Haq's military regime. By his early 30s, Haqqani had built a reputation as a silver-tongued communicator with a knack for moving between Western and Pakistani audiences. After Benazir Bhutto became prime minister on a progressive, secular platform in 1988, the conservative opposition leader, Nawaz Sharif, tapped Haqqani to develop his media strategy. By Haqqani's own admission, Sharif was exploiting xenophobia and anti-Americanism. But Haqqani felt Sharif might be able to bring some balance to the country after almost a decade of military rule. It wasn't long after Sharif took power, and after, in the conventional cycle of Pakistani politics, Bhutto was ousted on corruption charges, that Haqqani found himself at loggerheads with his boss. In 1992, as the Soviet war faded and the United States became more brazen in its misgivings about Pakistan, the State Department asked Haqqani to help deliver a message to Sharif. The United States knew that Pakistan was providing material support to groups that have engaged in terrorism and lying about it. It had to stop, or the U.S. would add Pakistan to its official list of state sponsors of terrorism, triggering crushing sanctions. Sharif gathered his cabinet for a conversation that pitted Islamist generals against progressives like Haqqani. The ISI chief at the time, Lieutenant General Javed Nasir, reflected a traditional Pakistani outlook. The letter was the fault of an Indo-Zionist lobby and a Jewish ambassador. That the ambassador, Nicholas Platt, was in fact a Protestant was the least of Haqqani's concerns. As Haqqani told the story, he made the case that Pakistan should reconsider its use of proxy relationships in favor of a greater emphasis on diplomacy. When Sharif sided with the intelligence and military voices, Haqqani threatened to quit. Sharif made him take the ambassadorship to Sri Lanka instead, a way of neutralizing him without the negative press. It was the Pakistani equivalent of exile to Siberia. A year later, he resigned. But Haqqani was nothing if not resilient. After new elections brought Bhutto back into power, he became her spokesperson. He stood by her after she was, like clockwork, ousted again on corruption charges, and grew more public in his criticism of Pakistan's military and its vice grip on power as civilian leaders came and went. It won him few fans. In 1999, Pakistani intelligence agents pulled him off a crowded street, threw a blanket over his head, and pushed him into a waiting car. On a cell phone secreted in his pocket, he dialed a friend who alerted the media. He credits the call with saving his life, though he remained jailed for 2.5 months on trumped-up corruption charges. When General Pervez Musharraf seized power, Haqqani realized he couldn't live safely in his homeland during its frequent bouts of military rule. "He didn't look very kindly on my writings at the time," he said of Musharraf. "I felt very pressured because it was military rule again. So I left. I came to the U.S. Hussein Haqqani Americanized. He took an associate professorship at Boston University, decrying Pakistan's military leadership from a safe distance. Haqqani and Benazir Bhutto, in the midst of her own exile in Dubai, often talked about the future of Pakistan. She had him draft a paper outlining a new vision for Pakistani foreign policy, should she return to power. He argued that the military-to-military relationship had reinforced Pakistan's sponsorship of terrorism. Pakistan had become a rentier state, living off payments from a superpower for its strategic location and intelligence cooperation, rather than its aligned interests. The flow of easy cash from the United States fueled the disproportionate power of Pakistan's army and intelligence services and blunted the potential for reform. Bhutto liked the paper and the idea of a new relationship with the United States that would be strategic rather than tactical. For one moment, it looked like she might get a chance to make that vision a reality. After years of diplomatic pressure from the Americans and the British, Musharraf allowed Bhutto to return to seek election. There were plenty of people who wanted her dead, and she asked for more security after narrowly escaping one bombing. Musharraf granted only some of the requested reinforcements. "If anything were to happen," she emailed her lobbyist, Mark Siegel, "I would hold Musharraf responsible." On December 27, 2007, as shadows lengthened in the late afternoon, Bhutto left Liaquat National Park in Rawalpindi, less than 2 miles from the headquarters of the Pakistan Army, after a stump speech calling for democracy. Supporters swarmed her white Toyota Land Cruiser. Bhutto, wearing her trademark white headscarf and a purple kameez over simple white cotton pants and black flats, climbed onto the back seat, poked her head out of the sunroof, and waved like Eva Peron on the balcony. Gunfire cracked through the air, accompanied by the deafening explosion of a suicide bomber detonating his payload. A Getty photographer, John Moore, activated his camera's high-speed motor drive, capturing the out-of-focus chaos. An orange fireball, frightened faces surging through sparks and smoke, survivors staggering among bodies. Bhutto was dead. Her will passed leadership of her political party to her widower, Asif Ali Zardari, known by critics as Mr. 10%, as a result of long-standing corruption allegations. Her grieving supporters swept him into the presidency. During Bhutto's exile, Haqqani had grown almost as close to Zardari as to her. When Zardari and his prime minister, Yusuf Raza Gilani, were looking for a new ambassador to the United States after the election, they asked their old party spokesperson, Hussein Haqqani. He accepted. In June 2008, he headed to Washington and presented his credentials to George W. Bush. Haqqani was back in power. But many Pakistanis regarded him with suspicion. His switching sides to work for Bhutto, a woman he once campaigned against, was a mark against his loyalty. And some viewed his flight to America as a Rubicon. Days after Bhutto's assassination, Musharraf had anatomized what he viewed as her failure. One all-important rule she broke: don't be seen as an extension of the United States. Haqqani, fresh from years of American exile, was picked for the ambassadorship for precisely that unforgivable quality. Years later, Pakistan's Express Tribune opened a profile of Haqqani with George Orwell's description of Squealer in Animal Farm. A brilliant talker, and when he was arguing some difficult point, he had a way of skipping from side to side. None of this, of course, is to draw a comparison to the esteemed Mr. Hussein Haqqani, the profile continued. After all, Squealer remained loyal to the pigs throughout. Chapter 6. Duplicity. Richard Holbrooke had been a prodigiously young Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia during the Carter administration, before departing to Lehman Brothers during the years of Republican leadership between his diplomatic posts. As in all his roles, he grew close to the journalists around him while working on East Asia. As luck would have it, that included Strobe Talbot, who had, as predicted at Oxford, gone on to a career in journalism, covering foreign affairs for Time. Holbrooke's contacts in the Clinton administration were thin. He had backed Al Gore in the 1988 primary and sat out the Clinton campaign almost entirely, though not for a lack of trying. He badgered friends from Vietnam with better proximity to Clinton, like Anthony Lake, to whom he sent an unsolicited memo describing the brewing conflict in Bosnia as the key test of American policy in Europe and warning of the danger of inaction. Holbrooke watched, frustrated, as plum positions went to Lake and other peers. It was only after lobbying from Talbot, who was appointed Deputy Secretary of State, that Holbrooke was asked to take the post of ambassador to Germany. And it was only by sheer willpower that he ascended to Assistant Secretary of State for Europe, and then to the defining role of his career as the administration's negotiator in the Bosnia conflict. The ethnic slaughter sparked by the disintegration of Yugoslavia had, for years, been an intractable problem at the periphery of American interests. By 1995, at least 100,000 people, and upwards of 300,000 according to some estimates, had been killed. Faltering efforts at mediation, including one led by Jimmy Carter, had barely interrupted Serbian forces' aggressions against the region's Muslims and Croats. It was only after the massacre of thousands of Muslim men and boys in the town of Srebrenica drew international outrage that the United States shifted from its conviction that the violence was a European problem and greenlit a more aggressive diplomatic push. Holbrooke had always viewed the conflict in grand terms, as a test of NATO with potentially dramatic consequences for the future of Europe and, by extension, American strategic interests. When the Clinton administration was deciding who would lead the new intervention, Holbrooke campaigned for the position hard. He was disliked, but some saw his maverick style as a positive. The very qualities for which he was sometimes criticized, aggressiveness, impolitic interaction with adversaries, a penchant for cultivating the media, were exactly what the situation required, Secretary of State Warren Christopher said. The parties to the conflict, Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic, Croatian President Franjo Tudjman, and Bosnia's Alija Izetbegovic, were scrappers with a history of underhanded tactics. Richard Holbrooke was a rare figure who could meet them toe-to-toe. Years later, President Clinton toasted Holbrooke with a gentle jab. Everyone in the Balkans is crazy and everyone has a giant ego. Who else could you send? Over a three-month period in 1995, Holbrooke alternately cajoled and harangued the parties to the conflict. For 1 month, he all but imprisoned them at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, a stage where he could precisely direct the diplomatic theater. At the negotiations' opening dinner, he seated Milosevic under a B-2 bomber, literally in the shadow of Western might. At a low point in the negotiations, he announced that they were over and had luggage placed outside the Americans' doors. Milosevic saw the bags and asked Holbrooke to extend the talks. The showmanship worked. The parties, several of them mortal enemies, signed the Dayton Agreement. It was an imperfect document. It ceded almost half of Bosnia to Milosevic and the Serbian aggressors, essentially rewarding their atrocities. And some felt leaving Milosevic in power made the agreement untenable. A few years later, he continued his aggressions in Kosovo and finally provoked NATO airstrikes and his removal from power to face trial at The Hague. The night before the strikes, Milosevic had a final conversation with Holbrooke. "Don't you have anything more to say to me?" he pleaded. To which Holbrooke replied, "Hasta la vista, baby." Being menaced by a tired Schwarzenegger catchphrase was not the greatest indignity Milosevic faced that week. But the agreement succeeded in ending 3.5 years of bloody war. In a sense, Holbrooke had been preparing for it since his days witnessing the Paris talks with the Vietnamese fall apart, and he worked hard to avoid repeating the same mistakes. Crucial to the success of the talks was his broad grant of power from Washington, free of micromanagement and insulated from domestic political whims. And with NATO strikes authorized, military force was at the ready to back up his diplomacy, not the other way around. Those were elements he would grasp at and fail to put in place in his next and final mission. Dayton made Holbrooke a bona fide foreign policy celebrity. The next year, he received a Nobel Peace Prize nomination. A Time magazine political cartoon envisioned him as Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible, dangling on a wire over the region, sweating bullets. But just a year after Dayton, he was passed over as Secretary of State in favor of Madeleine Albright. Holbrooke, devastated, accepted a post as U.S. Ambassador to the UN instead. I know he wanted to be Secretary of State, Albright said. But I was. It was kind of a surprise to many people, but I think especially to him. Al Gore later said Holbrook would have been first in line to be Secretary of State in a Gore administration in 2000. Circumstance always just managed to snatch away the job he wanted most. When Richard Holbrook presided over the signing of the Dayton Agreement in 1995, the United States had only just begun slashing away at diplomatic spending, and the shift to military and intelligence